Welcome to the Midland Seventh-day Adventist Church. We hope our broadcast will bless you.
You know, when you were a young person, some of you remember skipping stones across the surface of a smooth lake or throwing them into a pond, and you remember how inevitably the ripples would flow from the impact of the stone. It's very much like that with choices. The choices we make, they create ripples. Effect on our lives as well in the lives of others. The choices we have made throughout life determine where we are, where we are going to be, and what we're going to become. And these choices are also telling what we really want, what we love, and think, and they all show up in the choices we make. Let me take you through a time frame that begins with Usher's chronology, 404 BC, which is really a date that we aren't certain it's when time began for this earth, but we can assume that it's close. But first, before we get to 404 BC, let's go back even farther BC. Let's go back to heaven. Here we have God making some decisions. Decisions before sin and after sin. First, He had to provide a plan for the possibility of sin. And that plan, we understand, dealt with the mystery of iniquity. Secondly, He had to provide a plan and a means for all to be redeemed, should the plan be necessary. And then we find out in Revelation 12, 7, 8, and 9, that there was war in heaven. And the war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon with his angels fought. But they did not prevail, nor was place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. There was war in heaven then. And then there was a decision for God to make also then. The decision was to destroy, and I put behind that never, because God doesn't work that way. He gives all an opportunity, even Satan. Cast out, yes. He was cast out. You know, Lucifer might have remained in favor with God and beloved and honored by all the angelic host, exercising his noble powers to bless others and to glorify his maker. But little by little, imperceptibly, he came to indulge a desire for self-exaltation. It was just I. And we find out in Isaiah 14, Isaiah writing about Lucifer and all this eye trouble that he was having. It's found in Isaiah 14, 12 through 15. How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. How you are cut down to the ground, you who weaken the nations, for you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit on the mount of the congregation on the far side of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Yet you shall be brought down to Sheol, to the lower depths of the pit. But he persistently defended his course, maintained that he had no recent need of repentance, and fully committed himself in the great controversy against his Maker. And now we come to 4004 B.C., Adam and Eve, the first two people to populate or inhabit the earth. Creation, people created in the image of God. A test, a very mild test. For there's no need of eating of food. I mean, they had plenty. Everything that was there satisfied their wants. But the only knowledge they gained by their disobedience was a knowledge of sin and its results. And age after age, the curiosity of men has led to seek for the tree of knowledge. And often, like Solomon, research they find it only getting vanity. It wasn't long after Adam and Eve were escorted out of the garden, that we find the word I coming in again, selfishness. We find Cain the two sons of Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, and we find them out in the field. Previously, Cain and Abel had made an offering to God. And you know, Cain had offered what he thought was best, and Abel thought what God had said was best. And we know that the results were that Cain's offering did not express a faith in God. He had doubt in his mind, and with his doubt in his mind and the madness in his heart against his other brother, what did he do? He went out and slew his brother in insane madness. As I said, how quickly selfishness came into the picture. And then it wasn't long, as we go down through the generations, we come to the seventh generation of Enoch. He didn't see, he saw God by faith. He didn't have any "it is written," as we do today. He bowed in a pure atmosphere, though. He didn't locate in a Sodom, thinking he could save the cities. First, he was the first prophet in all of mankind to prophesy the foretelling of the coming of Christ. He had a wonderful life of oneness. But he saw many, many ungodly deeds. And it wasn't long before, if we read in Genesis 6:3, the end of the Diluvian world, there was giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children of them. There were the mighty men who were of old men, of renown. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of their heart was only evil continually. Here we find man's choices versus God's choice. And we know the results. Man's choice was a continuation of evil in their hearts, to the point where God said, "I can't live with this any longer. I've got to do something about it. I have to make a choice." And the choice he made, but he preempted it with 120 years of warning, that he would destroy the earth. And during that 120 years, there was a man named Noah who found righteousness in the eyes of God. You know, Noah was asked to build something he never saw before, or has never been needed, because there was never a flood. He was asked to preach something he had never heard before. But we know that he found grace in the eyes of God, and he acted upon what God asked him to do. We read that in Genesis 6, 13 and 14. "And God said to Noah, 'The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence. Through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood.'" Gopher wood. The only relationship I have with gopher wood is my father, because he used to turn it on a lathe when he worked in a machine shop. Norman probably knows what gopher wood is, but other than that, I'd never heard it before. It's a very impervious kind of wood. But he was told to build an ark. He acted. The flood came. The earth was destroyed. 8 people were saved through the decisions that Noah made to honor God and his word. 75-year-old Abraham, we read in Genesis 12:1, "Now the Lord said to Abraham, 'Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you.'" He's 75 years old. He's set in his ways. He's lived there all his life. He's made friends. He has family. God says, "Get out. Change your domicile." And he moved. Made the decision to move. But then along came another decision. God had made a promise to him. There would be this, all the earth would be populated, and he would be kind of the father of all the seed. Couldn't wait. And what happens? Well, in Genesis 16, 3 and 4, we find that "Then Sarah, Abraham's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband, and Abraham to be his wife, after Abraham had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan." So he goes into Hagar, and they have a child. This wasn't to be. But he made a wrong decision here. Right decision to move, wrong decision in terms of the heir to the Jewish nation. But then he turns right around, and God comes along and says, get up, go to this mountain. And when you go to this mountain, I want you to take your son, get some wood, and go and sacrifice him. And what is Abraham doing? Doesn't argue at all. Packs it up, packs the mules up, gets two servants, and away they go. And you know the results. Here we have an example of loyalty, trust, and faith. But I forgot to mention that when Abraham was 75 years old, and when he came to Canaan, he took a man named Lot with him. You remember Lot? Well, a little while later, in Genesis 19:14, we find Lot running around the neighborhood in the middle of the night. And what is he doing? So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law who had married his daughters and says, get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city. But to his sons-in-law, he seemed to be joking. You got to be joking. Hey, this has never happened. We got a beautiful city here. And so Lot's children made a decision. They were given an opportunity. They made a decision. The decision was to stay. And if you remember, as the angels were ushering out Lot, his wife, and his two daughters, they specifically said, don't look back. Get out of the plane. Get all the way to the mountain. Don't look back. It wasn't like we always hear that Lot's wife was so turned, and maybe she was, for all the great things that were in the city that she was going to lose out on. But she was instructed, and by God's angels, to don't look back. And what does she do? She makes a decision, and she looks back. And in Genesis 19, 17, and 26, we find this. Genesis 19, 17, and 26. So it came to pass, when they had brought them outside, that he said, escape for your life. Do not look behind you, nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed. And then we find in verse 26, but his wife looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. She made a decision. She had a choice. She made a decision. She looked back. A little later on, we find someone saying, look, I'm about to die. This is Esau coming into the camp. He's hungry. He's been out hunting. Can't find anything. I'm about to die. And the birthright, well, it lost its sacredness. In his mind, he wanted food was more important. He had a strong desire for particular food. He gratified himself so long he didn't feel necessary to turn from the tempting, coveted dish. Yes, there was some chicanery in all this, but Esau had the last choice to sell out or stand for right. Then later on, we find out that there's a man named Joseph. And his decision was a momentary decision. But that momentary decision was fortified by the impressions that had been made and had fortified his heart prior to the moment when he was enticed by Potiphar's wife to go to bed with her. And he said, how can I do this thing and sin against God? A momentary decision made because he had a great deal of fortification before that moment happened. And the victory he gained by fleeing the enchanter saved him. We go down a little farther and we find Moses. You know, somewhere I just saw recently a picture of Ramses. The tomb was opened up. You know, he would have been there too, probably. But you know, I wonder, and Ramses was very young when they were discovered his sarcophagus. And I wonder if Moses saw these young people, all their idolatry, but also their end, and what they did, and how they furnished their wonderful tombs, and said to himself, you know, really, I don't think I really want a part of this. And we remember, if we read in Hebrews 11, 24 through 26, Moses' decision. Hebrews 11, 24 and through 26. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, now becoming of age could have been 12, because in the Jewish nation, when you were 12, you became of age, you were considered a man. But I'm not sure, maybe this time he was close to 40, I'm not sure. When he had become of age, what did he do? Well, it says that he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, and that might have been Hatshepsut, by the way, Pharaoh's daughter, Hatshepsut, choosing rather to suffer the affliction with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. So I say Moses saw the foolishness of his life when he became of age. He faced reproach rather than riches and rewards for the moment. But his decision was an eternal decision, and we know the results. And then there stood Joshua. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. So, who are you going to serve? He's telling these people. Put away the gods. It's a moral man to prefer the praise of men to the favor of God, the rewards of iniquity to the treasure of heaven, the husks of sin to the spiritual food, God is his children. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And then we come down to Gideon. He ends up in the faith chapter, Hebrews 11:32. How does he get in the faith chapter? What did he do? Well, he did a lot, in a way. It's proving his faith. You remember, he had 30,000 men. He's going to go down and take care of the Midianites. God says, no. No 30,000 men. Let's winnow them out. And so they winnow them out. They continue. Finally, they get down to 300 men. You know, if you read any war stories, 300 men against 100,000 men doesn't seem like a very good balance and a very good opportunity to overcome the enemy. But what does Gideon do? He makes a decision. He listens. Gets his 300 men, tells them what to do, and we know the results. They rout the Midianites. I want it. It looks good. Get her for me. Well, that's Samson. You know, a worldly wife or a worldly friend is a spy in the camp. Samson failed where Joseph overcame. Samson, under similar temptations, which had been brought upon himself, he gave loose rein to passion. He deliberately walked into the net of the betrayer, yet he ends up in the faith chapter, as Gideon. But it was based more or less on a deathbed situation, recovery, repentance, which is a sad story, but yet it ends up positive. Don't leave me. I like the way you live. I wonder who I'm talking about here. Well, it's Ruth. If we go to Ruth 1:16, we find a young woman saying to her mother-in-law, Naomi, don't leave me. Your gods will be my gods, and your ways, Joshua judges Ruth, will be mine. Evidently, Ruth saw in Naomi something that she wanted so badly that she was willing to make a decision to turn her back on the land of Moab and move on with her mother-in-law. In Ruth 1:16, we find this. But Ruth said, entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go, and I will lodge. Your people should be my people, and your God, my God. So here we find the influence helping, in this case, to make a decision. And think of the results of that decision, the lineage that was created that had been going on to David. It was tied to David, that decision, in some way. And eventually what? Beyond to Christ, that whole lineage, by that decision. And then we come to Eli. Well, you know, if we read in 1 Samuel 2:22, we find Eli was very old, and he heard everything his sons did to Israel and how they lay with the women who assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the meeting. So he said to them, why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil dealings from all the people. He's remonstrating with his kids. But Hophni and Phinehas couldn't be remonstrated any longer. And because Eli had not raised them well, he failed to restrain them from following their own perverse will. It's a terrible example of parental unfaithfulness. And we see the results of mistaken kindness. You know, there can be mistaken kindness, and here's where we see it in Eli. And the strong warnings that we read in 1 Samuel 1 to 22, where they were too late. They were basically too late. And you know the results, what happened. They were all, the boys were killed in battle, and Eli died by falling back and breaking his neck over the sorrow of his children. A sad story. And then we find Saul, who shows how far his decisions carried him, eventually speaking with the devil. And we can read that in the book of Samuel. And then we see David. And you know, they say a picture's worth a thousand words, and seeing Bathsheba, I guess, tells it all. This is also a moment decision causing a lifetime of sorrow. We read in 2 Samuel 11, 2 through 5, Then it happened one evening that David arose from his bed and walked on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold. So David sent and inquired about the woman, and someone said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" And David said to the messengers, took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her, and she returned to her house. And the woman conceived, so she sent and told David, "I am with child." And you know the results of the heartaches of what David went through. But fortunately, that was a negative and a bad decision. But then if we turn to Psalms 51, 7 through 11, we find David making these statements. Psalms 51, 7 through 11. He says, "Purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I will be whiter than snow. Make me hear joy and gladness, that the bones you have broken may rejoice. Hide your face from my sins, and blot out all of my iniquities. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast away me away from you, and do not take your Holy Spirit from me." So we find him sinning to making a decision in later in life to repent. Go fast, and if I perish, I perish. Here was a consecrated woman acting an important part. She's saying to her whole group of entourage, remember, she's now the queen of Sheba. I'm not, of Iran, you might say. And fasting and praying, she asked, and this prompt action, this prompt decision, met the issue and brought the salvation to her people, if you recall. Daniel. We read in Daniel 1:8. Daniel purposed in his heart to do what? Well, he said in 1:8, "But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he may not defile himself." And here we find Daniel placing himself on the side of righteousness and trust. He knew in order to come off the victor, he must have clear mental perceptions that he might discern between right and wrong. And then, if you recall, throughout his life, he gave to God all the glory of his secular, scientific, and religious endowments. And then, who could neglect the three Hebrews? Right there with Daniel. "We have no need to answer," they said. "Nor will we worship, nor will we serve." And you know the results. They lived when they were threatened to be thrown into the fiery furnace. And then we have Jonah. No, yes, maybe, finally. Oh, okay, I'll go. Well, he rises and he flees. He's picked up by a fish. Throw me in the sea. Fish swallows him. "Yes, Lord, I made a mistake. Get me out of this fish." And the Lord answers, and the fish vomits him on the beach. And then he arises, and the Lord says, "Go to Nineveh." Okay, I'll go. And he goes to Nineveh. And then, you know, then finally it's complaints. So, yes, no, yes, no, complaints. But that was Jonah. Now we come to Jesus, the most important person that ever lived on this earth. And we know that Adam yielded to the power of appetite. And this is an insight that I never thought about before. And I heard this given in the Port Charlotte Church just a couple weeks ago. Same idea. Christ is our example in all things. His anguish was not from hunger, 40 days, not from hunger, but from a sense of the fearful result of the indulgence of appetite and passion upon the race. That's what he was anguishing about. It wasn't because he was hungry. He was worried about what hunger would do to people and appetite and passion as he looked down in time to see our nation, our world, and the way it was going. And then also, that was in Matthew 4:10. And then Matthew 26:42, we find a momentous decision being made. Matthew 26:42. Here he's making the decision that affects you and me today. 26:42. And again, a second time, he went away and prayed. Oh, my Father, if this cup cannot pass away from me unless I drink it, your will be done. He made the final decision. I will go to the cross. That was the second decision, you remember. The first decision was made in heaven. Remember when I began? We made this plan. Now I'm making the decision. I will go through with the plan. Tied to Christ, we find many individuals making decisions. We find Matthew. Come, follow me. Whoa. Okay, I'm done doing tax collecting. Probably didn't happen just that quick, but he probably wound down, balanced the books, and said, okay, here, take it. I'm gone. I'm following Christ. But Matthew makes another decision. He calls his friends together and shows his appreciation for the honor bestowed upon him. He calls together all those who have been associated in business with him, in pleasure and in sin. Gets them all together, makes a decision. I'm done with it all. I'm making a decision. I'm following Christ. And then you remember the prodigal son. Does all these bad things, takes half the father's net worth, goes and, you know, and just spends it wildly with wild women and whatever. And then he's sitting one day feeding pigs and he comes to himself and he makes a decision. I will arise and go to my father. And he gets up and he goes. And we know this is a parable, but it's just like us today, feeding the swine and finally coming to the decision saying, I'm wrong. I'm going to arise and go to my father. He does, and we know how the father accepts him, and it's a wonderful parable. And then we find the Good Samaritan. Actions. His action came, his decision was the result of compassion. He made his decision because he saw this person in need. He had compassion, and you know what he did. Jumped off his donkey, put some medicine on the man, and took him, housed him, paid for his keep. A wonderful decision, and would show to us that's the kind of decision we might make today. The thief on the cross, we might say, was a deathbed conversion, a decision made for eternity, but it was made in a moment. Lord, remember me in the day when you come. And what did Jesus say? I will. This day, I say, you will be with me in paradise. And then we have the sad story of Judas. Everything to gain, but he put self in front of everything, resulting in a decision for eternity. Not an immediate decision, but a gradual one with a final decision to sell his Savior, later making his last decision, and that was to die rather than face the balance of life. And then we have Paul. What would you have me to do? The Lord stops him in his tracks on the way to Damascus. Lord, what will you have me to do? Stop persecuting me. That's the first thing. And then go over and to the prophet and show yourself and you'll be told. And we know what Paul did. He made a decision and we know what Paul did with the rest of his life. We have about half of the New Testament or more to prove it. And then there was Demas. He bartered away every high and noble consideration. He was so short-sighted in the exchange that he made. And then there's Felix. is quite base and incontemptible. He had a better knowledge of the Christian religion probably than the Jews because he was home-based in Caesarea. And he respected Paul. And if you remember, he said to Paul, "Hey, I'll see you another time. When I have a convenient time, we'll get together again." Well, you know what happened? It never happened. He lost his wealth, and I didn't know this, but he lost his beautiful wife in the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. So Felix made some bad decisions. And then there was John Wycliffe, who made the decision to oppose the teachings of the organized church. He believed the contrary to the Bible. It was John Wycliffe who recognized and formulated the formal principle of the Reformation. He was a unique authority of the Bible for the belief in the life of the Christian. The Pope was so infuriated with John Wycliffe, 44 years after he died, he dug up his bones, crushed them, and scattered them in the river. And then in Bohemia, there was a man named Hus who was teaching, who was a priest, who was a Catholic priest, who made a decision to go against the church. And you know the results. The church finally said, "Recant." He says, "I will not recant. Recant or you go to the flames." And John Wycliffe said, "Most joyfully I will wear the crown of shame for thy sake, O Jesus, who for me didst wear a crown of thorns." And when the flames kindled him, he began to sing, "Jesus, thou Son of David, have mercy on me," and so continued unto his voice was forever silenced. And then there was a Waldensee, Bartholomew Hector. He was a bookseller who was dragged to Turin to answer for the crime of selling Genevieve books. His defense was before the judge. "You have been caught in the act," said the judge, "of selling books that contain heresy. What say you?" "If the Bible is heresy to you, it's truth to me," replied the prisoner. "But you use the Bible to defer men from going to Mass," urged the judge. "If the Bible deters men from going to Mass," responded Bartholomew, "it is proof that God disapproves of it and that Mass is idolatry." The judge, deeming it expedient to make short shrift with such a heretic, exclaimed, "Retract." "I have spoken only truth," said the bookseller. "Can I change truth as I would a garment?" And then in Germany, the Pope called Martin Luther to Worms. He's not coming. He doesn't dare come. He knows we'll get him. No, the government says he's coming, and we'll guarantee his safety. And so they got together at Worms. And you know, it was a dramatic moment in this courtroom. And some questions were put to Luther, and Luther said, "I cannot and will not retract, for it's unsafe for a Christian to speak against his conscience. Here I stand. I can do no other. May God help me." And then there was William Tyndale, first person to take advantage of the Gutenberg movable press type for the purpose of printing the scriptures in English language. He was speaking to a clergyman who was hopelessly entrenched in the Roman Catholic doctrine. He said, "I defy the Pope and all his laws. If God spare my life ere many years, I will cause the boy that drives the plow to know more of the scriptures than you." Tyndale was betrayed by a friend, tried for heresy and treason, strangled and burned at the stake. His last words, "Lord, open the King of England's eyes." This prayer was answered 3 years later in the publication of King Henry VIII's 1539 English Great Bible. It's May 5th, 1945. The war in Europe is about over. But the war in the East, or the West, I should say, maybe, the East, West, Australia. The Americans had taken Saipan, they had taken Guam, they had taken Wake Island, they had taken Guadalcanal, they had taken New Guinea, and the Americans knew that they had to take Okinawa, because Okinawa was the base where they could launch the bomber attacks on Japan. They were launching the men from a farther distance, but they knew that they had to take Okinawa to get in striking distance more easily of Japan. They were firebombing Japan at the time anyway, But Okinawa, they had to take. And on that island were 600,000 people and 100,000 Japanese soldiers entrenched, so entrenched that we didn't know they were that entrenched. Unbeknownst to the command of the United States Army, Air Force, and Navy, that the Manhattan Project was underway. You understand, only 2 months later, the atomic bomb was dropped. But they knew that they had to take Okinawa to get an air base. And so the invasion took place. And on this May 5th of 1945, there was a young 24-year-old corporal named Desmond Doss. It was a bloody battle, and when it would end, there would be 100,000 Japanese soldiers died because they wouldn't be captured. They said, we will die for the emperor rather than be captured. And 30,000 Americans died on this battle for Okinawa. Up on that escarpment, where bloody battle was raging, where men were being killed by the minute, was a young corporal moving back and forth amongst his men. Before he had gone up there, though, he had made a rope such that he could hang down from the escarpment. And you know, as he was moving from men to men, he was saying, Lord, help me one more, just one more, was his prayer during those hours atop a blood-soaked escarpment on the island of Okinawa. And after the last man was evacuated, Doss himself made his way to safety. He's the only one that ever earned a Purple Heart that never carried a gun. He was earlier mocked because he was a non-combatant, and also ironically, one of the men that he had saved had previously tried to intimidate him and even had to try to remove him from the outfit. Oskar Schindler. At first, he seemed like every other usurping German industrialist, driven by profit and unmoved by the means of his profiteering. But somewhere along the line, something changed. He succeeded in his quest for riches, but by the end of the war, he had spent everything he had made on keeping 1,300 Jews alive, men and women. He negotiated the salvation of these people by operating right in the heart of the system, using all the tools of the devil, bribery, blackmail, marketeering, and lies. And as the brutality of the Holocaust escalated, Schindler's protection of his Jewish workers became increasingly active, watching innocent people being packed onto trains bound for certain death. Something awakened in him. Beyond this day, no thinking person could fail to see what happened, he said later. I was now resolved to do everything in my power to defeat the system. Perhaps the question is not why did he do it, but rather how could he not? And perhaps the answer is unimportant. It is his actions that matter now. Testimony in the worst of circumstances. The most ordinary of men might act courageously. If Oskar Schindler, flawed as he was, did, then so might we. And that is a reason to hope. Peekaboo! Cried Eric Harris as he suddenly slammed his fist on the tabletop of desk, as he asked Cassie Burnell if she believed in God. Yes, was her response, moments before fatally being shot at the Columbine High School. No time to reason or bargain, just making an eternal decision. Gabrielle Weiner. She was born in Brussels, Belgium. She was the child of Dutch parents. She grew up in Cologne, France, in the Ain department near the Swiss Alps border. Her father served as a minister of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. She was sent to secondary school in London and, as a result of her background, spoke several languages. She was a devoutly rich girl, religious girl, and she was living in France, in Paris, at the time of the outbreak of World War II. With the ensuing German occupation of France, Weidner fled to the South with her brother Jonathan, Hendrik Weidner. Following the June 22, 1940 agreement between the Reich, the German Reich, and the French Vichy government, they knew they had to flee, but their resistance, and as their significant, they had to flee, they realized that they needed to do something. Now, what did they do? They formed a Dutch-French line of passing prisoners from France out into either to Switzerland or out of the country. And in this resistance efforts, they saved 1,000 persons, including 800 Jews and more than 100 downed airmen. However, on February 26, 1944, the Gestapo arrested her along with 140 members of the network. She was interrogated and tortured, and then shipped in a railroad car to Ravensbrück concentration camp in Germany. There she was kept in horrific conditions, subject to beatings and used as slave labor. And on February 17, 1945, Gabrielle Widener died of malnutrition in a Ravensbrück subcamp a few days after being liberated by the Soviet troops, a decision made by a person who gave all. Dudley Canright was a pastor in the Seventh-day Adventist Church for 22 years. He rose through the ministry. He had a position of prominence in the General Conference. He briefly served as secretary to Ellen White, who had encouraged him to enter the ministry. At age 24, he was ordained. He married Lucretia Cranson. Now, she was an orphan that was adopted by Ellen White. And for 20 years, he labored as a minister and evangelist in the Seventh-day Adventist Church across the United States. He was a notable contributor to the Review and Herald. And he was elected to many prominent offices. He was frequently called upon to debate our denomination against other denominations. But in 1880, he became disillusioned with what he considered autocratic behavior. But back in 1881, he was back in the church, remarried, traveled as an evangelist, but abruptly in 1887, he turned his back on the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Joined the Baptist Church, became a minister, and wrote a book called Seventh-day Adventist Renounced. March 16th, Ken Wright, it was accompanying a friend named Morrison, to one of our meetings. And somehow, after he left the meeting, he went back to his Baptist church. They had been doing some reconstruction, didn't see it, fell down the stairs, and was laid there for 2 days, sadly, until someone found him. But he never came back. But at Mrs. White's funeral with his brother Jasper, he said, "There is a noble Christian woman gone." Herbert Blomstedt, or Blomstedt, is a Swedish conductor. He is a Seventh-day Adventist. He won the Kozovitsky Conducting Prize in 1953 and the Salzburg Conducting Competition in 1955. Maestro Blomstedt is mostly known for his performance of German and Austrian music. He's a devout Seventh-day Adventist. He does not rehearse on Saturdays. The Sabbath is the seventh day, he said. He does, however, perform concerts since he does not consider this work. Herbert made a decision there. And during the decade of 1985 through 95, he was the conductor of the San Francisco Symphony. And today he is conductor laureate of the Symphony, the San Francisco Symphony, the Bamberg Symphony, the Danish National Symphony, and the Leipzig Gewand Haas Orchestras. And lastly, Eliza von Takarutimani. Eliza von Takarutimani. In February 2003, International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda found Takarutimani and his son Gerard guilty of genocide committed in Rwanda in 1994. Somehow this gentleman, even though Ramsey Clark had defended him and said that he was a pacifist who couldn't even wring the neck of a chicken, was declared guilty of genocide. And he was a Seventh-day Adventist pastor who turned his back on the Tutsis. And many, many hundreds of Tutsis were murdered because he moved them into a church, and there they were slaughtered. A sad decision, I might say, for humanity. As you leave this sanctuary this morning, please consider your choices you'll make this coming week and reflect on the ones that you have made that seem to trouble you at this very moment. Decisions that will affect children, individuals, mates, fellow workmen, church members, church programs, the state, the nation, your attitude, your health, your walk with Christ, others, eternal destiny. Our lives are not made by the dreams we dream, but by the choices we make. So let's make excellent ones. Do a deed of simple kindness, though it ends you may not see. It may reach like widening ripples down a long and lone eternity. I challenge you to make excellent choices and watch the ripple effect of their blessings.
You have been listening to the broadcast from the Midland Seventh-day Adventist Church at 2420 East Ashman in Midland, Michigan. If you are in the area, we cordially invite you to visit our church Saturday mornings. If you are a distance away, we encourage you to continue visiting our website and weekly podcast at midlandsda.org.